Especially teenagers are very sensitive. You know, sometimes they literally, they come to their parents and they say, Mom, yeah, Dad, you know, especially if you are coming in front of my friends, so make sure to wear that and to ride that kind of car, you know, because that is their life. So we should appreciate, we should just take it easy. And one more thing which is really important is to respect their friends. You know, they're sensitive about their friends. So you, if you want to be attractive, whatever they say, take it easy, take it light. Don't take it very serious and very deep. Don't make it a big issue. You know, sometimes parents, they are making a small thing a mountain.
Very big.
That is something really, really,
And that's why our, all the prophets and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they would give so much importance to their appearance. They emphasize on wearing nice clothes and using fragrance and taking care of your appearance and your beauty. I will share a small hadith from the Holy Prophet. He says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never sent a single apostle or messenger who had an ugly appearance.
Beautiful.
This also shows so
like,
many
like the
things,
way our Prophet, he said, Prophet Yusuf is beautiful, but I'm more attractive.
Unfortunately, again, we are running out of time. Dear listeners, thank you for joining our program. If you have any question, comments, or any suggestion, you can write us at englishradio@irib.ir, and you can follow us on our social media, Call of Islam Radio, and you can visit our website, parstoday.com. Until next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite the illegal U.S. sanctions, or more properly, intense economic terrorism, the Iranian people, with their patience, resilience, and spirit of sacrifice, have made the plots of their enemies go awry, to the extent that they are models of emulation for the masses and the independent governments of the region and beyond, which seek the Islamic Republic's positive influence to the chagrin of the U.S. and its surrogates, says Kahan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading Keys to Iran's National Strength. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Reports from Vienna say the talks between Iran and the 4+1 group of big powers are on hold because of unspecified external factors, which means the United States, which is not a party to the talks because of its illegal withdrawal from the 2015 Geneva Accord, is not serious in rejoining the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, that requires Washington to remove all the sanctions that were illegally imposed on the Islamic Republic by both the Donald Trump regime and the previous one of Barack Obama. This is proof of the fact that the U.S., the cause of crises all over the world, remains the enemy of Iran and the Iranian people, and will resort to any unprincipled move to what it thinks would undermine the progress of the Islamic Republic. Does this mean Tehran should bow to blackmail in the misconstrued hope that the great Satan would give up its devilry and allow the Iranian people a bit of relief from what it thinks has reduced them to misery? Absolutely not, since such a self-humiliating approach is tantamount to placing the fate of the country in the hands of its chief foe and becoming a satellite state of the U.S., as was pre-revolution Iran during the despotic rule of the British-installed Pahlavi regime. So, what is the solution? Is there any remedy for Iran to safeguard its hard-earned independence and remain master of its own affairs with firm resolve to continue the path charted out by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul, to whom Iran owes its present power and prestige in the region and the world? Of course, there is thanks to the able leadership of late Imam's worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to whom Iranian people are indebted for their mastering of the intricacies of modern science and technology, including the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, missile power, the cyber field, and artificial intelligence. Yes, despite the illegal U.S. sanctions, or more properly, intense economic terrorism, the Iranian people, with their patience, resilience, and spirit of sacrifice, have made the plots of their enemies go awry, to the extent that they are models of emulation for the masses and the independent governments of the region and beyond, which seek the Islamic Republic's positive influence to the chagrin of the U.S. and its surrogates. Thus, what is important for us is not the revival of any flawed accord that binds our hands or reaching a new agreement that curtails our inalienable right to explore new vistas of peaceful nuclear energy. But, as Ayatollah Khamenei recently said, what is of significance to Iran is increasing national strength on the basis of Islamic concepts to build a flourishing economy, undeterred by external factors, ensuring a strong security and defense to protect the Islamic Republic and its independence, and a strategic engagement in regional affairs to thwart the transgression of outside powers. To some, it is these brilliant guidelines of the leader of the Islamic Revolution for whom the economic welfare of the people is tied to diplomatic strength and bargaining power for ensuring national interest at the regional and global levels, an indomitable defense industry, and an appealing logic that influences other nations and brings a strategic depth to the country, which are keys to Iran's national strength.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. In this episode, I have to tell you something about purification, or what is better known in Islamic terminology as tazkiya. The term tazkiya actually originally means pruning the plant to remove what is harmful for its growth. That is called tazkiya. And it is a word, it is a term that we usually come across when we discuss about, you know, self-purification. Just as we remove what is harmful for the growth of a plant, we also need to remove and to simply do away with what pollutes our soul. And it is actually the task of a gardener to trim and remove the harmful branches and to provide what the plant needs to grow. There is something to be, for example, cut off, and there is something to be given to it. In order for, just I'm giving you the example of a gardener who takes care of a plant. So in order for a plant to grow, there is something to be cut off and there is something to be given to it. And these dimensions are to be taken into consideration when it comes to human beings as well. When the term is applied to the human personality, it means to beautify it, to remove from it all evil traces, and to remove from it the diseases, the spiritual diseases that are obstacles in getting close to Allah and in achieving proximity to Allah. In Islam, the ultimate objective of religion in Sharia, Islamic law, and the real purpose of raising prophets and sending forth prophets from among mankind is performing and teaching tazkiyah. That's the whole and sole objective, the most important purpose of creation. You know, tazkiyah or purification cannot be achieved without, you know, following the teachings of the Prophet. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We have been created to achieve tazkiyah, to purify ourselves. And then through purification, we can achieve proximity to Allah and we can live a better life and we can live a happy life. Let's not forget that man acts of his own choice and free will. And this is one of the basic differences between, for example, a plant, a tree when it is pruned, and a human who is taught to purify himself. You know, we have been created free. We have been created to act of our own choice and of our own free will. I gave you the example of a tree. The tree has no intention or volition of its own. Actually, it is the gardener who attends to the plant. It is the gardener who cuts off its branches whenever he desires and whenever he wishes. But human beings are not as such, you know. Men are rational agents and they cannot be forced to accept something, especially a moral thing, you know. They cannot be compelled to do something. Man has to act of his own choice, of his own free will, if he is to purify himself, if he wishes to bring changes to his life, and if he wants to purify himself and achieve perfection and live a better life. Something is moral when one acts arbitrary of one's free will. If you are forced to do something, it's not moral. You will not achieve perfection and you will not achieve any reward whatsoever because there is no compulsion in religion. La ikraha fi din, qad tabayyana ar-rushd min al-ghay. The right is clear from the wrong and there is no compulsion in religion. Innaka la tahdi من أحببت ولكن الله يهدي من يشاء وهو أعلم بالمهتدين. Surely you cannot guide whom you love, but Allah guides whom He pleases, and He knows best the followers of the right way. You know, verse 56 of chapter 28. The most important point that I would like to discuss with you, my dear brothers and sisters, is that man has been created free and he has to act of his own free choice in order to be able to achieve perfection. He cannot achieve perfection by force or through compulsion or by way of, you know, predestination or, you know, predestined determinism. We do not believe in determinism. We do not believe in compulsion, you know. We believe in the middle way, you know, middle path. And we also believe that man is responsible for his acts because he has been created free. So some people may think that because according to the verse, you know, وَهُوَ أَعْلَمُ بِالْمُهْتَدِينَ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ هَدِي مَنْ يَشَاءُ. So the Quran says, and that verse which I recited, God purifies whomever he wants. Some people might say that if God is purifying us, why should we make efforts? Why should we strive, you know? That's a misconception, I think. And that's a misconception, a kind of misunderstanding on the part of some people. We are free and we act of our own free will. But we should not think that we are acting independently of Allah. You know, God has given us the power, God has given us the free will. And without these, without power, without free will, we cannot act. These are the gifts we have been bestowed by Allah, of course. We should also understand that tazkiyah cannot be materialized and cannot be achieved without one acting of his own free will.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
And we should also understand the difference between tazkiyah in terms of, let's say, pruning and tazkiyah in terms of purifying the human soul, you know. When it comes to pruning a plant or a tree, so that's one form of tazkiyah, that's removing the unwanted branches. And tazkiyah in terms of purifying the human soul is that man can engage in self-purification, while a tree or a plant cannot do so. So a tree waits for the gardener to be, you know, to come and to remove the extra unwanted branches. But man does not have to wait. Man has to learn from the teachings from the Quran, from the teachings of the Prophet, how to purify himself. And self-purification is quite, you know, relevant, and it gives sense in respect of the human beings. When a person, for example, wants to purify himself, he should not wait for someone to teach him. He should not actually always wait for someone, because the teacher, the Prophet, has provided us with light, with guidance. He has to benefit from the guidance, and he should not wait for someone to teach him, to nurture him, and to help him, actually. He should purify his soul himself, and he should embellish it. He should make it, adorn it by himself, and no one else can do it. He himself should take the matter into his own hands and purify himself. That's all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah
the limelight.
For the majority of Americans who are so poor they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP, says Tom Hartman, writer, in an article published under the heading The GOP is actually running on raising taxes on the poor and destroying medicine and social security. Here's the story. Republicans want to raise taxes on poor and working class Americans and social security and medicine, jack up pollution and corporate profits, all while continuing to pamper their billionaire donor base. This time, it's the guy in charge of getting Republican senators elected and reelected, Florida Senator Rick Scott. You may remember him as the guy who ran the company convicted of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of America, who then took his money and ran for governor of Florida, where he prevented the state from expanding Medicaid for low-income Floridians for all the years he ran the state. Now he's the second richest guy in the Senate. And IMHO, the leading candidate for the GOP nomination for president in 2024. And true to form, he is echoing the sentiments of the richest guy in the Senate, Mitt Romney, the last guy before Trump to have that nomination. Ron said of Obama voters back in 2012, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food and housing, you may name it. There are people who pay no income tax. Low-income working people in America generally pay a higher percentage of their income as taxes than do most of U.S. billionaires and multi-millionaires. They pay Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, taxes in the form of fees for everything from a driver's license to road tolls to annual car inspections. As Romney pointed out, though about 47% of Americans in 2012 made so little money that after applying the standard deduction, they paid no income tax. This doesn't just reveal how few people pay taxes, though. To the contrary, it reveals how many Americans are living in or on the edge of poverty. The simple reality is, if you want more people to pay income taxes, all you have to do is raise working people's pay. We saw this in a big way between 1950 and 1980 when Keynesian economics reigned and labor unions held wages, and the taxes they paid steadily rise for working people. But Republicans don't like the idea of what they call wage inflation. They'd rather just squeeze working people harder while continuing their subsidies of the lifestyles of the morbidly rich donor class. More than half of Americans make so little money from their employment that they can't deal with an unexpected $1,000 expense like a car accident or medical bill. And it's these very people who Rick Scott and the GOP believe need to be further taxed so they will have what Scott calls skin in the game. In the early years of the Reagan administration, before his neoliberal trickle-down and supply-side policies started to really bite Americans, only 18% of Americans were so poor and their income didn't qualify to be taxed. As a right to work for less, laws spread across America and Republicans on the Supreme Court made it harder for unions to function. More and more working people fell below the tax threshold. Today, it takes two working adults to maintain the same lifestyle that one worker could provide in 1980. So an estimated 61% of working Americans this year will make so little pay that their income isn't subject to taxation. Ricky Scott and the GOP's solution to this situation isn't to raise the income of working class people. Quite to the contrary, they are suggesting that low-income people should be hit with their very own income tax, in addition to the dozens of other taxes they're already paying. Also, multimillionaires and billionaires like Scott and his friends can hope to see their own taxes go down a tiny bit. Doing his best imitation of New Gingrich, Scott has rolled out his 11-point plan to soak the American middle class, lock down elections, destroy consumer protections, increase pollution and climate change, and squeeze a few more dollars out of every family, no matter how tight their budgets may already be. Scott calls this rescuing America, and it may be true if you're morbidly rich and made your money spewing pollution or hustling opioids. His plan not only calls for a 50% cut in the IRS workforce, presumably to end all audits of rich people like Scott, but also demands all federal legislation to sunset within 5 years. That would almost certainly end Social Security and Medicare programs that have been in the crosshairs of Republicans since Reagan's day. Realizing how raising taxes on 60% of Americans' voters will play in campaign ads, Mitch McConnell has backed away from Scott's bizarre proposal. But Fox News is all over it, inviting Scott on repeatedly to hawk his plan and prepare the ground for his candidacy. After all, billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and his family need their tax breaks. As Sean Hannity told Scott during a recent appearance, "I want to applaud you. I'd like to see the House and the Senate come together on these issues, make these promises to the American people, get elected, and then fulfill those promises." No doubt, multimillionaire Hannity was speaking his own words. But for the majority of Americans who are so poor, they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سید عبدالله الموسوی.
اعوذ بالله من الشیطان اللعین الرجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. اللهم صل على محمد و آل محمد و عجل فرجهم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the concept of justice and the concept of freedom, which stems from justice itself. When justice is applied, people get their freedom. We said for these concepts to be applied, we will need a ruler and a leader to make sure that these concepts are applied. Now, a ruler or a leader who wants to apply these concepts, he needs to have some certain traits himself. First of all, he needs to be a pious person. He needs to be a God-fearing person, first and foremost. If a leader, a governor, or a person in power,
he does not fear the Almighty, the Creator, then surely he will oppress people. Surely he will take the rights of others. Now, that's something that we see today and we saw in history. The only person who this did not fit was Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. For he was the most pious, he was the most God-fearing person that walked the planet Earth after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, which made him a candidate, an ideal person to assume the concept of khilaf and to rule people. And for such piety and fearness of Allah, the Creator, the Almighty, Allah has appointed him to be the leader. Having said that, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he was in power and even before, he kept himself free from all the pollutions in which the rulers those days were involved in. Now, sometimes people have sincere intentions to serve the members of society and society itself, and they come with genuine love for society. But once they get to that position of power, the environment around them pollutes them, and then they divert from their course. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that did not happen to him. He did not take advantage of his noble descent, which most people do. He never accumulated wealth for himself through his position and through his office. On no occasion do we see Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi display pride, which we see many rulers and kings before him did, and even our modern time, you see those who are in power, they try to bring themselves and display pride. They think they are the rulers of the world, where that was not something that Amir al-Mu'mineen did. He remained aloof from all irrational and worthless things that sometimes we might, as human beings, indulge ourselves in. He never preferred his kinsmen and friends to others, which sometimes we do a lot, especially when we have position of power. And when I take position and assume power, the first thing I do is to try to make sure that my friends and my family are well looked after. That wasn't Amir al-Mu'mineen's tradition or way or method of running things. He never nursed a grudge against any of his opponents. Like I said, to him, a friend and a foe were equal. And he even said, I don't care whether you're poor or you're weak. I will take the rights of the weak from those who are powerful. Because he wanted to serve the people, not the people serving him. Now, let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's self-conduct in trying to run the system and run government and becoming a leader for people, and he was making himself an example, first and foremost, for others to lead and to follow. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi was indifferent to the things which he ate or drank, the dresses which he wore, and the houses in which he lived. He utilized these things only as much as they were absolutely necessary for him. Now, we can see that whether it's me and you, or whether it's the kings and the rulers and those who have power, they always
eat and drink and dress and have houses more than they require. I mean, even on a personal note, I can relate to that myself. I always have things, and I eat things and I drink things more than I require. Now, obviously, that's not a very commendable human trait. But Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi himself, he never done that. He did not take anything from the public treasury to meet his personal expenses, which you see today in governments and in secular systems and even in the modern world. They give the governors and they give the people in parliament or people in power or statesmen or what have you. They give them direct access to the country's treasury for them to spend on themselves, be it on trips, be it on pleasure, be it on what have you. They get a plastic card that has an unlimited amount of money that they can spend. And this money is the money of the people. So these governments give themselves the right to take from the treasury for their own personal expenses. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi never did so. Never did he take a dime from the treasury of the Muslims for himself, nor for his family, nor for his friends. Although he could take at least as much as the governor of the province did. I mean, even we see that when Talha and Zubair came to him one day, he asked them, is this visit a personal visit or is it something that concerns the Muslim world and the nation? When they said to him, no, it is personal, he went and he turned off the candles and he lit other candles. And when they asked him why, he said, these candles are the property of the Muslims. If something concerns them, sure. But if it's personal, I have to light a candle from within my own. I can't give myself the right to take the rights of other people. Now, when you have such a personality, when you have a person in power that doing all these things for people, then people need to give him full allegiance. People need to give him the full cooperation in order for him to establish freedom and justice for them. When they don't, then the system will crumble and the rulers and the leaders in power will be oppressive and they will take their rights. Inshallah, we will continue this discussion in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shame Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Sheer Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan, but that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud.
We are now exactly at the mouth of Khure Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khure Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilak. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of